Thanks. I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk. There are, I think the motivation is fairly clear why I would like to start study extremal black holes. I should say that I will be basically interested in extremal but non-BPS black holes, and so the motivation is, I would say, not only to, you know, if you allow me to be optimistic to begin with, which we should always be, it's not just a matter of understanding entropy counting, which in some cases it works because some quantities are protected, as many of you know. But one would like to get some understanding on the microscopics. And my main motivation today will be to try to, from very basic considerations concerning the classical solutions that have been constructed in the last year or so in asymptotically flat black holes, to try to come up with a microscopic picture that at least gives you a point in moduli space where you can try to study quantum corrections, which is a question that, of course, all of you are going to ask me at some point of the talk. So I'm going to try to convince you that there is a potentially microscopic picture for asymptotically flat four-dimensional black holes. One thing, another direction, that's the one that I will explore mainly today, and because of lack of time, most probably I will not be able to touch another subject in which I think that we can actually make potentially a lot of progress, which is considering black holes in ADS, and in particular in ADS5. There are sectors in N equals 4 super young Mills which are characterized by giant gravitons, which are states, so basically I should say probably R-charged black holes, to be more precise. But there is potentially a general story for the Gutowski real black holes also. So these are sectors of in N equals 4 super young Mills of very heavy states. And just as when we deal with asymptotically flat black holes, we have learned due to the decoupling ideas of Maldacena and followers, it's kind of natural to analyze the near horizons in these black holes. And since there are theorems in 4 and 5 dimensions with or not with or without the cosmological constant restricting the geometries of the near horizons, you always get in some near extremal limit, you always get perturbations of either ADS2 or ADS3 throats. So clearly, this is, I'm just mentioning this here because I think that there is, it could be extremely nice to match some predictions from N equals 4 super young Mills coming from information from integrability, if you would be able to include non-planar corrections or things like that. But if I have time, I will come back to this at the end of the talk. I'm just mentioning it as a very natural direction to follow, because these black holes in ADS, we believe that we understand in some regime the microscopic. So they are given in terms of giant gravitons. And so if you are very close to extremality, the entropy is basically accounted by the open string to stretch between these giant gravitons. But having mentioned this makes me feel that I have already said something about ADS. So let us focus on four-dimensional black holes. And for definiteness, I'm going to consider black holes in the so-called STU model. And since it's kind of like long to write all the details of this theory, of course, I will just mention the minimal amount of information that I need to tell you in order to feel comfortable to follow the discussion, hopefully. So this is an N equals 2 Sugra theory in four dimensions. If it helps to have intuition in case that you have not dealt with these theories, please think about type 2A compactified on 96. And basically this is a severe truncation of the full degrees of freedom that you have in this 2A theory, in which you are only keeping three complex scalar fields.
Doesn't keep the supersymmetry.
Sorry?
Is it some orientable fold?
Well,
you don't just mean the prepotential is ST.
Exactly.
You
yeah.
don't care about it.
So this is written in terms of some prepotential. But yeah, it's a truncation, so I will only keep some of the degrees of freedom which I'm going to describe right now. So basically, these complex fields, I'm not sure I will use this that much, but these are the complex fields, and intuitively, these XJs account for the B fields, the fluxes that you can turn on in each of these, the magnetic fluxes that you can turn on each of these T2s, and roughly speaking, the IJs know about the sizes of this toroid. So this is a way of keeping track of this, and then the electric and magnetic charges of the theory are described by a bunch of gauge fields. Okay, now, more importantly, these gauge fields give rise to 8 different possible charges, and I want to introduce this notation for later. There are, generically, I will denote this by this notation, from 0 to 1. There are 4 of them which are electric, and these are the Q naught, which I will denote the charge of the D0 grains. So I will be using the language of 2A, though I have compactified, and then there are the QIs, which are the two grains wrapping TI, T2I, I guess. And then the magnetic duals, you can imagine which are the charges that will appear. D6 grains, which are wrapping T6. And then the other three PI are D4 brains that are wrapping a T4. Okay? So basically you are wrapping these two, let's say, and then because of magnetic duality, the other one is turned on. Okay. So these are the 8 charges in the theory. Good. And so the first thing that I need to, because, you know, maybe 1 year and a half ago, these solutions, believe it or not, in an arbitrary value of the moduli that you can turn on at infinity, which I will be denoting by this. The solutions were not known, so let me give you a flavor of how to, what to expect and how to look for the most general solution in these theories. Of course, there are experts in the field that can tell you how to do this, but I want to do some counting to give you some intuition for how to look for these solutions using the u-duality invariants of this theory. This theory is invariant and the u-duality, which in this case is SL2R³. And so if you ask yourself what is the most general solution, you are welcome to add the further comment that reduces the simplification, that simplifies the problem. You are looking for the most general solution up to the action of this u-duality group. Now, generically, if you look for black holes, we know, let's try to do some counting, we will have the mass in 4 dimensions, the angular momentum in 4 dimensions. We have 8 charges, and we are allowed definitely to choose wherever the moduli is at infinity. This is what I have called this. These are 6 extra parameters. And the u-duality group, you know, because of the size of SL, you are allowed to subtract 9 parameters because of the u-duality, roughly speaking. This is a heuristic argument. We should use group theory to do this properly. Now, here comes the simplification of dealing with extremal black holes. In the case, so I'm going to make 2 assumptions. The first one, which has been overcome lately by Ben and collaborators, is that I'm going to assume a spherical symmetry. So all this talk is going to be focused on a sector in which there is no angular momentum. And we expect that some of the comments that concerning the marginality of these black holes that I will come in some minutes will not appear when J is different from 0. So that's one assumption. And the second one is extremality, which basically allows me to think of the mass as just a function of the charges. So for the purpose of parameter counting, what I have is that these extremal black holes, you expect them to be described by 14 parameters minus the action of the SL2. So you expect three parameters for the general solution. So what we did with Finn Larsen and Eric Gimond was, and I should say this because usually I don't stress these things and some people may have different pictures, is that when you want to discuss extremal non-BPS black holes, you can choose in which duality frame you are going to work. You can work with what people call the D0, D6 frame. You can work in this frame. These are just your choices, or you can work in the intersected distributed brain project that Gary and Roberto push. All of them are related by U-duality, and what you can prove is that there is a single orbit of SL23R that relates all these guys, so there is no need to worry about anything else. So make your choice. So to begin with, what we did was to work in this one, and whenever I will need to make comments about other frameworks, I will use just U-duality mapping the charges and the corresponding moduli. So because of this assumption, the metric, let me make sure that I always have this lecture with signs, is the warping factor with a plus. Okay. So we look for a configuration that look like this, just to give you a flavor of what the problem will boil down. It will boil down to a classical mechanical problem in the R direction, and then all your moduli will be a function of R. And basically the gauge fields are determined by the Gauss law. Well, of course, by the charges that you want your solution. This fixes the magnetic sources, and then the Gauss law fixes the... Okay, so when the dust settles, there are very nice mathematical techniques that people have developed. In our case, we honest to God deal with the Lagrangian mechanics problem that arises in the setup, and you hope for the best and integrate. So basically what I want to stress, sorry, is that out of the five parameters that the most general, so I should have stressed this, sorry, I have chosen four of them to be charges. The amount of D0 brain and the amount of this D3 different. So basically I have turned on P1, P2 and P3. These are three of the parameters. The charge of the D0, Q0, that's the fourth parameter. And there will be a fifth parameter, which we chose to be for technical reasons, I have to say. The fifth parameter is an equal B field. So we are allowing ourselves to turn on the same B field in all the three tolerances. So this will be the three parameters, the five parameters of the solution. And for completeness, even though I'm not going to use this, the solution looks like follows. What determines the metric is it has a very similar structure, since I will be comparing this with the BPS branch. It depends on four harmonic functions, which carry the four different charges and take care of the boundary conditions at infinity. So in case that you have not seen this, and if you are worried about this minus B squared, this is cancelled by this. These are the standard harmonic functions that usually appear in supersymmetric solutions. And okay, and if you worry about the scalar fields, I can give you this close expression. Okay, so this is the solution. I do want to emphasize, probably because I have not worked enough in supergravity, so it definitely, even though there is a sense in which the talk starts now, I mean, it's really difficult, at least for someone like me, to get this solution. So one has to appreciate all all the work that people do along this. No, I mean, I don't want to, please, Arkady.
An S frame for UGLs when you have only NS charges.
Sorry?
A frame where you have only NS charges.
I would have to think about that. It may be. I don't know by heart. Only NS charges. Let me think. 86. I'm not sure. We would have to analyze the action of the orbit. I know that I can move from this sector, and for intersecting the three brains, because these are the frames that I have used. But this precise question, I don't know. You are worried that maybe the solution was written before. It could be. I mean, I was in communication with the group of De Lagata, and they told me that they were the first in finding the solution using their attractor equations. But you could still be right. I don't know the answer. Please.
I think you can, because if you go back, so the original black holes were G1, D5, and momentum. So you can S-dualize that to the fundamental string, NS5 brains and momentum. And then you get the fourth charge, you can add a Kluze-Klein monopole, which I think Rob Myers did.
Rob is not here today.
That solution we discussed.
So you get four, right. So you get four charges in four dimensions, which are all in the Bichors.
And then you can also put the fifth charge as well.
But it's not a fifth charge. This is just a fifth parameter. The fifth parameter is just the B, the two-point B string. And that's the Bichors. So I think it's a...
Okay. Please,
so if this was really a generic N equals 2 supergravity with three vectors, I mean, you have an attractor phenomenon, but the near horizon structure would change as a function of the z's at infinity. So that doesn't happen here at all. So
I should have mentioned this. I decided not to make that many comments about the attractor mechanism. But in the case of extremal non-BPS black holes, not the attractor doesn't fix all the exactly. So what happens is that there will be two flat directions in this story. Yeah. And this is again a statement for u-duality guarantees that this will be true for all these black holes. Yeah. Okay, so now, you have these solutions, and the first thing that you do, and to be honest, as far as I'm concerned, this is part of whatever it will follow later. I can expand this function at infinity. That's what we would do in an AEDM construction and try to read the mass of this black hole. And I guess that a posteriori we were kind of lucky to work in this framework, in this frame. But what you find is that the mass of this black hole, let me make sure that I use the same notations all over. This is twice Newton's constant in four dimensions. What you find is this apparently very nice expression, which involves naively, but what I'm going to do actually is I'm going to explore what this result seems to suggest. We have started looking for a configuration that carries these four charges, and each of these, if I take each of these constituents, if you allow me to start using this language, each of the constituents is half BPS, and I could compute the mass of each of the constituents because this is BPS, and what you would obtain is that this thing here is the mass of your D0 brain, and these pieces here, which are a sum of three different pieces, are the masses of your D4 brain wrapping two of your tori where there is a magnetic field B. Think of the DBI contribution, for instance, to the energy. You have two tori, you will get a 1 plus B squared A squared, and when you take the square root, that's gone. So apparently, I would say naively, it looks like we have a bound state at threshold. So basically what I'm trying to say is it seems that at this level, classically, there is no binding energy between these constituents. Of course, when I'm making this claim, I am already putting myself in the situation that I would like to understand the microscopics of these black holes in terms of the constituents that I started. But that's what the supergravity solution is telling me. Okay, please, Gary.
So in the supersymmetric case, you know, this was also true, but it was not a surprise, right?
Wait. I'm not sure. Yeah, let me write down the mass for the BPS solution because I don't think that's true. So maybe I'm misunderstanding. So actually, let's compute the mass, the BPS mass for this same configuration. And what you get is the norm of this complex number. I mean, basically what happens is that in the supersymmetric case, the central charge has a non-trivial phase. And so you do get a bound state in that case when there is a B-field. Sorry. Okay, so probably that's your observation. Yeah, sorry. And that's precisely what we want to discuss, right?
But now you've added a B-field.
Exactly. So notice that when there is no B-field, indeed, this non-trivial phase of the central charge, which I have not defined because of lack of time, is gone. So then the observation goes. Yeah. So one observation is that this quantity here, whenever the B-field is different from zero, is always larger than the BPS when it's different from zero. Okay? Now, one comment which, as far as I understand, is related to the work of Roberto and Gary concerning the counting in the absence of B-field of these configurations is that if you ask me about, you know, I have computed the first natural observable out of the solutions, you could ask me about what happens with the entropy. Before doing any calculation, and because of the arguments that Gary and Arkady were alluding to, the entropy has to be u-duality invariant. So the people know how to write this. This is what people in the literature call the quartic invariant. And indeed, when you compute the entropy, depending on which conventions you use, this is the answer that you get with J for some function of the charges, which I'm not going to write because time is already running. But the observation is that BPS black holes, and maybe these days I should be a little bit more precise, single center. This took me a while to realize, but indeed one has to be more precise these days. Single center BPS black holes do have J4 positive. Whereas the ones that I have constructed, or that the community has constructed, non-BPS extremal ones, single center, to have J4 negative, but the entropy only cares of the absolute value. So this is suggestive that there may be a very easy way of accounting for the entropy of these black holes. And one comment, since it has appeared in this parenthesis, is that, for instance, in the D0, D6, people in the audience that may have followed this story, there are no single center supergravity solutions being BPS that carry the zero and the six brain charges realized as single centers, but there are multiple center solutions in which you have two centers. I will come to this later, but definitely the solutions exist, and we believe that we understand partially what is going on there. So that's concerning the entropy, at least to begin with. Now,
John, could you just comment briefly on the distinguished role of the zero charge? I'm a little bit surprised that it's not appearing in a symmetric combination with all the other charges.
Okay, I'm not sure what you want me to comment on.
It appears from your formula that u-duality does not permute the zero brain charge into the other charges, and I just wanted you to comment on that. Make
me
feel happy with that.
Okay, since it's always a pleasure to make you feel happy, I'll try. sorry. I mean, actually, I could extend this to anyone in the audience. Maybe one intuitive reason is that the zero brain is just a point source from the perspective of this T6 in which you are wrapping. So this D0 doesn't see the moduli.
If you turn off the B field, there'd be so much more.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, that's, yeah, indirectly is what I was trying to say.
The B field. Yeah. The B field is effectively a fifth charge in this problem, right?
Well, I don't view it as a charge. I mean, I view it as a parameter. Yeah, it's a flux. It's a modulus, yeah, sorry. Does this sort of...
That explains things. Thank you.
Okay, good. One thing that eventually I'm going to come back, because this is a very bold statement at this point, is that if you want to check whether this is true or not, a couple of very easy checks that you can try to do is, first of all, if it's true that the constituents of your black hole don't feel any binding energy, one thing that you can try to do is you can try to modify your black hole by introducing quanta from infinity. Sorry, Shami.
I just wonder how bold your statement is. You're saying this for asymptotically large values of charges up to 1/charge corrections, right? You're not really...
It's a classic, absolutely. This is a statement in supergravity. Yeah, I'm not using any quantum theory at this point. But in that regime, for instance, I could decide to say, okay, let's modify this Q naught, say, by a small perturbation. If it really doesn't, if there is a cancellation of forces in this regime of approximation, you should take the DBI action, compute the potential that this extra quanta fills, and you should see a flat potential. So actually, this is something that you can do, and you can check that this is true. And if you do the same with the other D4 brains, you also get the same thing. And since we have already mentioned this issue about single and multicenter, if it's really true that the constituents of my since I am exchanging the order in the talk. One thing that I want to emphasize, which is consistent with what we were discussing with Gary, is that contrary to what you may think, of course, once there is a B field, I think that all of you agree that this is an honest to God bound state. If you actually compute, if you try to put an extra quanta of this zero brain in a supersymmetric black hole, the potential is not flat. There is non-trivial binding energy here, and the DBI is aware of this. So what I'm saying is that in the non-extremal, in the non-BPS case, the potential that your probe fills is flat in the DBI approximation. So take your black hole, put it in the background of your probes. Of course, if you take a probe which is not one of the constituents that you see, it will fill a force. So that's what I meant by here. And we can also go to Subra. There is a paper by Gaiotto et al. In which they studied the moduli space of some n equals 2 theories, and in particular, they analyzed the moduli space, actually, of some coset theories. And one of them is the coset that corresponds precisely to having turned on this equal B field on all the 3 T2s. So, in particular, equal the field STU, if you want, well, being imprecise. What they discover is what they call, for their interest, of course, the result that they get is that this moduli space is trivial in the sense that they look for solutions of supergravity which are going to be parameterized by harmonic functions. And now these harmonic functions have some constants that depend on your moduli at infinity. Here I made some choices. But then you have a sum over some charges. This is where the different centers are. What they claim is that the locations are free they are not constrained. Notice that this is very different from the BPS story, in which the absence of singularities in supergravity puts you a non-trivial, non-linear constraint for the locations. But what they are claiming is there is no constraint on the centers, which means, in my interpretation, that the constituents are free to move. So this is consistent with that picture. And the only constraint that they get, nicely for us, for their interest, this was trivial, I agree, is that there are constraints on the charges. Sorry, can everyone see? Probably not. Sorry. Is this the tangle here? So the locations are unconstrained, and the charges PJK do have to satisfy some condition. And the nice thing is that if you pick your reference frame, which in this case it could be the V0 bar, three V0s, the charges that satisfy are precisely the ones appearing in Sugra. So the ones that actually don't feel an energy or linear combinations thereof. So the two natural checks that are available in the classical literature seem to be consistent. This suggests that if you would be able, actually in Benna's paper, I believe that this is already there, but the solution is written in different variables, if you would be able to construct solutions where the B fields are different, because our argument suggests that even though I started with equal B field, I could use the action of SL2R to bring my moduli to three different B fields. So, and the mass is u-duality invariant, so that should still be no binding energy. So there should be supergravity solutions which are multi-center, but this is to be seen. But let's not finish the discussion. We have only made these comments based on the mass of our black hole, and we have checked that at least in the classical regime there is no potential, and this seems to be consistent. But there is let us go to a framing which people have put some thought in the past, which is the D0, D6, and let's compare this with the Washington-Taylor construction of metastable bound states, and which is very similar to the picture that Roberto and Gary were advocating. So let's move forward. We will not need the Sugra solution, I guess, but for completeness, I hope this was useful. So, let us move to T0, T6. And the thing is that, as Arkady and Gary have already said, basically once you have the solution in one frame and you have the constituent, so once we have the constituents in this frame, basically what you are saying is, I'm saying that I have four independent constituents. Let me call this by gamma I. And this is basically just the charge vector that each constituent carries. By each constituent I. We know how the charges transform under the SL2 cube u-duality transformation. So what I'm going to do is, when I map this using some u-duality transformation, let's call it U1 to the D0, D6, which can be written down explicitly. And in the process, I can actually turn on all the different B fields that I still didn't have in that picture. I can analyze the image of the constituents under the map U1, and I will get something that, let's call it gamma I twiddle, and we can analyze which are the charges that you get, because you will expect to get, you know, these charges were very nicely, I only have D0, I only have D4. Now under this U-duality, I will generate all sorts of terms. So if you are curious, for instance, if I start with gamma D0 bar, I'm gonna use this notation, P naught, Pj, Kj, K naught. If you, the details of U1 are sort of ugly, so apologies, I'm not gonna write this thing down, but the vector charge that you get is something as follows. You have this 6-brain charge. You have some flux. Sorry, this will be too small. So some D4-brain charge also. Remember, the PJs were D4s. There will be also some... I will define these gammas in a second. So. And some D0. Now, so what I want to emphasize is that this is what you obtain from one of the constituents, and I, just for the sake of this D4 brain and D2 brain charges, they come with some fixed signs, and these are charges in the different tori. So let's call this minus, 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 plus, plus, plus. Let me just introduce this notation. When you actually do the same calculation for the three other constituents, which we had in that system, you will get four charge vectors which look exactly the same in absolute terms, and you will only get some arrangement of the signs, which starts reminding of the Watty-Taylor construction of metastable bound states. So just for the sake of people that may have not seen this, these signs are just permutations. They look something like this. Minus, plus, minus, and they will satisfy the physical requirement, because otherwise you will, of course, complain. One is claiming that you are describing a black hole which at infinity carries only D0 and D6 brain charges, and the individual constituents do carry other charges, so it better be that when you sum the charges of the different constituents, the different contributions will cancel. And this is the play of the as you know, the interplay of the plus and minus sign. So this is what comes from the other three D4 brains. Now, what are these gammas? Well, these gammas are rotations that appear in the SL2 transformations. And this is a part of the story which puzzled us for a while, and there is something which I don't claim to have a deep understanding, but I hope to get some constructive feedback. So the transform, how is time? The transform charge vectors depend on these parameters gamma I, but this gamma I have to satisfy the following constraints. The first one is that their product has to be equal to the total D6 brain charge divided by the D0 brain charge. That's the first constraint. And we will interpret this very soon in Taylor's construction. The other ones are a little bit, well, they look non-linear. It's easy to justify why they appear. They involve the B fields. So when I do this map, I'm going to have three different B fields. These constraints are just remembering that you started with a solution in which you had a diagonal B field. So when you transform things, you get these equalities. At this point, this is just a technical result, and it's in what, okay, let me write it and let me talk later. Okay. So let's proceed step by step. You would like to interpret in the V0 bar D4 system, you had this nice, at least classical picture in which there is no binding energy. You are transforming the charge vectors of your constituents, and you would like to interpret what is the physical meaning of these guys here. What we would like, based on Taylor's work, if you want to, is to identify the constituents in the D0, D6 frame with arbitrary B-fields. Which was not done by Wattie, as four D6 brains with wall volume fluxes, and these fluxes Fi, the DVI fluxes, if you want to, have to be a function of the lambda J's. That's what I would like to convince you in the next minutes. That's the motivation. Now, if you go to the construction of Wattie, you are taking a non-abelian effective action for your D6 brains. I do emphasize that when he was trying to build these bound states carrying D0 and D6, he was not able to construct bound states with a gauge group that was smaller than 4. There is this nice observation that in Gary's and Roberto counting, you also need these 4. And we are sort of saying that this may be related to the fact that there are 4 natural constituents. And if there would be less constituents, supersymmetry would be preserved, as I would discuss in a second. But I'm just trying to put some things in perspective. But what he did was to turn on fluxes in the different T2. He chose precisely the same distribution of signs because this is the only way to make sure that you are not generating D2 and D4 brain charge. So what he did was, let's consider the gauge fields on the brain in the first torus, in the second torus, in the third torus for the rank 1 group, so the first box of your matrix. And he chose this to be F1, F2, and F3 for whatever values. And once you have chosen this structure, the other fluxes, when you break the U4 into U1-4, are going to be determined by the physical condition of carrying the right D0 brain charge and having 0 D4 brain charge and 0 D2 brain charge. So actually the signs that he was up to permutations, of course, are these things. So if you want to, the argument, which may have looked a little bit crazy when I was stating it, the first indication that there should be a relation between these wall volume fluxes of the D6 and the parameters that I have used in my SL2 transformation comes from the fact that in Wattie's construction, the same assignment of signs is precisely what gives this distribution of signs in the charges of our constituent model. The difference is that one difference is that in Wattie's construction, these Fs are arbitrary. There was no B-field turned on there. In our case, we do have a B-field, and the price to pay, for no apparent reason so far, is that whatever this function is, which we will determine it very soon, you are not allowed to turn on any flux, apparently, but it is implicitly and explicitly and implicitly depending on which B-field is actually threading your torus. So that's the extra condition, which comes from supergravity so far. So there seems to be a matching. And one thing that I should say, it's very long to write in formulas, but in words it's very easy. It is rather amusing that if I would have started looking for the most general black hole solution in supergravity in this frame, in principle, principle, I would have been able to solve the equations of motion in principle, and I would have expanded the warping factor at infinity to read what is the mass of the black hole, and I would have got an horrendous expression. So the mass in these units of the V0, V6 is some mess, no doubt. You have all these lambdas and Bs floating around, but once you have this sort of constituent model in your mind, you look for what you know what to look for. So it's nice that actually, if I normalize this in units of the volume of the T6 and the tension of the D6 rain charge, this mass is actually the sum of the four mass constituents when you break your U4 into U1 to the 4. And it coincides with the DBI mass. So the horrendous expression that you get in supergravity, you can arrange it to get a nice sum of pieces. And those sums involve the square roots of whatever with these signs. But it's nice to observe that both expressions match. And this is sort of consistent with the claim that the mass is U-duality invariant. So if I have a mass that is the sum of different pieces, actually what is happening is that each piece transforms with each other. Now, what about these nonlinear constraints? Is there a way that we can justify,
Okay, so once you have this result, can you then continuously vary all the moduli and it remains true that the mass of the black hole is the mass of your four constituents?
This is true for any value of the B field and for any fluxes, as far as we know, for any fluxes that satisfy that constraint. It's not true that the mass can be arranged into this natural form if this constraint is not satisfied, actually. But that's the only constraint. But otherwise, classically, it seems that this is true for any value of the B fields, or of the moduli.
I'm confused by something elementary. So in the original picture, you had a sum of masses of you had a bound state threshold of the D0 bar and the 3D.
That's right.
And now in your formula, the D0 has sort of disappeared, and you have a sum of D6.
Yeah.
So it's a bound state of the D0 D6 system with non-trivial binding energy, and the D0 tension is canceled, or you drop the.
Okay. So what happens is that the I should have stressed this maybe more precisely. In this frame, the constituents are D6 brains carrying fluxes. So they are not interpreted as D0 charges. Now, the way in which you induce D0 is through this coupling. Which is the coupling that you have in the D6 brain non-abelian action. And if you look, I have not been precise because the cancellations of the induced charges in the D4 and D2 brain sector forces you to change the signs. But the sign of the D0 part of all these charge vectors is always the same sign. So these D6 brains manage to induce D0 brain charge, but they are not D0s.
But there's a contribution to the mass from C3 of the bundle and the V6s or something from this character.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So actually, it's good that Shamit made this point because coming to this observation here, I've been just trying to tell you what the philosophy is, but technically, if I want to match these observations to Taylor's construction, the first thing that I have to do is to compute the induced D0 brain charge, which is what I'm denoting by Q0, compute it in terms of the gauge fluxes of the fluxes on the wall volume, which are these Fs. And since there is this constraint, I will reach a condition between the Fs and the capital lambdas. So let me write this down for you. This will still not answer the nonlinear constraints, which will be, the last part, definitely the last part of the talk. But I'm glad that I'm going step by step. So the number of the zero brains is basically proportional to the number of six brains. There are some pi factors and alpha factors. But basically, when the dust settles, you get that this is the number of V6, the volume of the V6. And basically, this is related to the charge Q0. The number of V6 is related to the charge of the V6. So at the end of the day, when you include the alpha prime units correctly, you get that this product has to be less U. And we know that this is equal to minus lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. So that's the first constraint of matching what is construction with our construction. But since I don't want to use the solution to this problem, because mathematically I could attempt to solve this problem, to guess the answer, let us try to use a further frame, which is the one that Roberto and Gary use for matching the entropy. If you take this D0, D6, or the D0 bar, D4, 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 and you bring it to a different duality frame in which you have four different planes that are intersecting in each of the tori, you get a picture, you get a system in which people have spent a lot of time computing the spectrum of open strings for completely different reasons. So once you are in this setup, we could have asked about the stability of the system already in the D0, D6. We are in a non-supersymmetric branch. You could ask whether in the open string spectrum there is any kind of tachyon or of any sort. It may be more manifest for some of your intuitions, the fact that this system is supposed to be equivalent to another one in which you have intersecting DC brains. And we've been told many times that depending on the angles between these DC brains, you may have tachyons. So actually, let's analyze this a little bit in detail. The bottom line, because I will have to go faster than what I expected, is that we will compute the mass of the scalar excitations that exist in the intersections of each of these tori. And this mass depends on the angles that your D-brains stand. But remember that what does the trick is you will do a T-duality here to a four D-brain, D-brain. Now, the data concerning the relative angle of these things is encoded in whatever fluxes you were having in the D6 brain formulation. So basically, for the expert, there are these tangents or cotangents of F plus minus dB filling whatever combinations. And so the hope is going to be let's compute the spectrum of these open strings that depend on these relative angles. The relative angles are going to be given. I will allow myself to use the same expressions derived from Sugra. Whether it is justified or not, it's a good question. Sorry.
Also, I mean, are you at large n, or large charge number? Because, you know, whether there's a tachyon or not often depends on that. So if you take an answer,
I am in the large charge, but since I am in a system in which my constituents don't feel any force, I am taking just two of them, and I'm computing the spectrum in the at zero coupling, and I'm going to show that it is precisely when these conditions are satisfied that there are no tachyons. I'm not claiming any deep justification, but in the supergravity approximation, I'm definitely in a large charge regime. But I also know that this, at least in the classical, in the gravitational description, these constituents don't feel any force. So what I have done by hand is I'm taking any pair of constituents out of these four. I analyze the pattern of angles tori by tori, I compute the mass, and then I require this mass to be positive or zero. And you know, it's a completely nonlinear equation, but actually if you allow me to use this condition, it boils down to a problem in four dimensions actually, which is the self-dual anti-self-dual solution. And basically the bottom line, because I'm not gonna write the equations I believe at this point, the bottom line is that the absence of tachyons in the perturbative spectrum for any pair of constituents in our system seems to be responsible. I'm not claiming that I understand why this survives all the way to the supergravity regime, but seems to be responsible for the perturbative stability of the system at the classical level. So, to put it another way, we can derive this supergravity constraint from the requirement of absence of tachyons in the zero coupling. So let me write the claim. So, and requiring the absence of tachyons is equivalent to this set of conditions. Actually, it's not. With the identification now, yes, which is consistent with this other physical constraint. Oops. I think that the answer is. So coming to Shamit's question, when I actually, so what I'm doing, remember, is that I have what is analysis in terms of these fluxes, but there is a matching between these variables and the variables that we were using in Sugra, which are these lambdas. The relation is given by this one, and these are the quantities plus or minus the B-field that control the relative angles when you leave the duality. Okay, so these are the bunch of checks that we have done. Maybe I can finish trying to emphasize a little bit the differences and similarities, actually differences, between the BPS branch and the non-BPS branch, because the entropy looks very similar, but as a way of summarizing what we have seen here, there are very different properties, even though the counting may well work for both of them. So trying to list these things as a sort of wrap-up. Let me call this BPS versus non-BPS. So first of all, we have reminded ourselves that there does not exist a single center BPS solution, whereas there are non-BPS ones. The second point is that there exist multi-center BPS configurations, for instance, one in which you have two centers. Actually, with Alejandra Castro, we have more general splittings than this, in the STU model at least. But basically, this is Witten's picture in this story. But remember that they don't exist everywhere in moduli space. So here we will start a discussion of the existence of a wall of marginal stability and where supersymmetry exists when there are B fields or not. So this is where the connection will come. But it's important to keep in mind that they do exist, but not everywhere. This is beyond a wall of marginal stability. That's what we know already. So in particular, since I write it here, this is the condition. Basically, you usually say that for large enough values of the B fields, you know that you will be in this part of moduli space where the solutions exist. So that's the claim. Whereas here, we are saying that if I take the Gaiotto result and I use it for arbitrary values of the B fields, which I think is going to be true, what we are saying is that there exist multi-center non-BPS configurations, but they are everywhere in moduli space. So this is another difference. So the classical moduli space is very different. Another comment is that the scale that sets the separation in the binding BPS system, it depends on these B fields. it depends on the charges and the moduli. Whereas what we are saying here is that unless there are quantum corrections that change the story, our centers are free to move in the non-BPS case. And some comments about supersymmetry. I was expecting to be a little bit more precise, but if people are interested in knowing how this is still apart, basically this is coming from the intersection picture. But
do you actually know anything about the moduli space? I mean, of the center?
Of this thing?
Yeah, take one of your solutions and you can move the constituents around. What, do you know what the moduli space looks like?
No. No. But I guess maybe in Gaiotto's paper, in the particular case of the equal B-field, because they use very different variables from the ones that I have intuition, maybe we can read the answer from there. But I don't know the answer myself. Now, concerning supersymmetry, The story between the two branches is also very different. Even if you allow yourself to put yourself in places in moduli space where these states exist, the actual constituents in the BPS case are mutually supersymmetric, and they carry this is well, so they are mutually associated. And what Denev likes to call mutually non-local, which means that the intersection number that you can compute out of the two vector charges that form these two constituents is different from zero. In other words, the supergravity configurations that describe the BPS branch carry angular momentum, whereas in our story, nothing carries angular momentum. And actually, if you ask me the question, what happens if you introduce a quanta to our system that has the right charges to be interpreted as a constituent, but you give it a kick so that it rotates, it develops, the flat direction is gone, and it wants to sit somewhere. So definitely it's very interesting to extend, to include this extra quantum number in the picture, because the binding picture is going to be gone even at the classical level when there is angular momentum. Whereas in the non-BPS case, this is a claim that I have not proved for you, but any three constituents that you pick out of four are mutually susy. It is when you act the fourth one that you break it. Please.
Situations that are kind of dumb where you get super symmetric properties out of non-symmetric things like order folding. Mm-hmm. So is there some frame, maybe this one that Jared said about earlier, but one of these things is an order fold projection of, you see, when you have six frames, they can be
lifted to monopoles, and they may be related to tau nodes or something like that.
There's some inheritance for this, in other words.
We were wondering for this for a while. It could be that the answer is yes, but I'm not aware of that answer. Yeah, but I'm sympathetic with that possibility. It would be a very nice explanation for some of these properties.
For general absent tachyon angles for the D3s, uh-huh. you get a spectrum that's not Bose-Fermi degenerate. I mean, you see it splitting immediately because the bosons are massive and they're Fermion ground states.
Uh-huh. So there is no room for supersymmetry.
It seems hard to believe there's some. Unless the angles are fixed to be exactly at the supersymmetric.
Uh-huh. You had a remark.
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, the statement that you just made, I think, shows that there's no tachyons, right? Because the tachyon would be an open string that connects only two of the constituents.
Okay.
And that's always possible.
And that's not
supersymmetric if you don't know what the other two are doing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that sort of implies.
It's not also
just
no form that you just.
So how much supersymmetry do you preserve when
three are
present?
So any pair of them preserves one quarter. When you introduce the other one, I think that you preserve 1/8, and then there are no mutuals, susis on the fourth one.
Okay.
Okay, so, sorry, I am already over time. So, I guess that I have tried to emphasize a very... of course.
Doesn't this also mean it's a supersymmetric Bose-Merry degenerate spectrum?
Yeah, actually, so his general angles there are... He must not allow general angles. In fact, must have angles that add up to 2 pi between any pair.
Yeah.
So it is
degenerate, in fact.
Oh, so then it could be secretly supersymmetric.
Yeah, you're right on the edge where the...
Well,
it could just be a projection. The spectrum is degenerate.
I see. But it's... Okay. I find it hard to reconcile with the explicit characterization of which supersymmetries are preserved constituent by constituent. I mean, I would be happy to discuss this in detail later, because we were definitely concerned about this issue that it could be secretly supersymmetric. But I mean, from the supergravity perspective, I would say that...
No, we're not secretly supersymmetric.
Oh.
Any pair has angles that add up to 2 pi, but the four together in the D3 picture might break all the supersymmetry.
Oh, okay. Okay, so then...
Is that the correct picture for these black holes in the D3 frame?
Yeah.
Four D3s. Yeah.
Okay.
In other words, the interactions will not be supersymmetric.
Exactly. Interactions will break. Okay. So we explore this in a rather conservative way. There is this picture emerging. I think that, you know, if people want to discuss, we had some thoughts on how to include angular momentum, but I had already made the main observation as far as I'm concerned. The easiest calculation that you can do is take your VBI plus this minoterm, kick one of your constituents, you get a non-flat direction, and probably this is related to the fact that people have not been able to find multi-center extremal configurations with angular momentum. The solutions that have been written down have always absence of angular momentum, but at least what I take out of this is that it gives us some confirmations on the picture that Gary and Roberto push for. It explains why this famous four appears in the different constructions, and it gives us basically some microscopical point where to start thinking, because if you want to study some more dynamical issues quantum corrections associated to the system, at least it gives you some point where to start. For instance, these non-abelian actions, or try to write an effective action in which you are consistent with all the symmetries of the spectrum and the degrees of freedom that appear in the open stream perspective, and maybe you will get some understanding for why certain conditions seem to be protected, which I don't understand. I don't understand why this condition that appears in gravity, for instance, is entirely captured by this condition at zero coupling. Maybe someone has some deep comment about that, but this is just something that occurs here. And of course, just for the sake of raising discussions, because I know that some people in Santa Barbara have been thinking about this, these guys are extremal, so, and they have a non-vanishing horizon, so it means that everything that Andy Strominger and collaborators and subsequent work have been saying, whether you believe it or not, it can definitely apply here. There is no angular momentum, but there are electric and magnetic charges, so you can leave the thing to five dimensions, and there is definitely an ADS to throat. So we have a picture here in which nothing has been said about this asymptotic symmetry group that you analyze in gravity. We have a completely different setup. And you may ask, well, if you believe in Andy's story, which you may not, can we come up with using the microscopic degrees of freedom that have been suggested here? Can we find a link? That's not clear to me, but I would be happy to discuss this. In any case, as I have said at the beginning, if you want to address this issue about extremal black holes and emergence of these conformal field theories, I think that you should ask it in black hole, in extremal black holes in ADS, where you can actually make more precise statements. Thanks.
What are your expectations about quantum corrections and the potential that they might generate on this module? Do you expect it to be the degeneracy to be preserved, or to get some binding energy, or to get a runaway? Do you have any
What I do expect is that there will be corrections, because, for instance, even the flat directions, the first question that Eva Shamit asked in the talk, there is evidence already in the literature that once you turn corrections in the context of extremal black holes, these flat directions are gone.
Which direction? Do you get a real bound state, or do you get something that runs away towards...
Well, the problem is that the paper that I'm having in mind is a paper, maybe there are others and people can point out to me. There is a paper by Sergio in which it's just a toy model, so I wouldn't like to use that information to answer. So the answer is that I don't know. Of course, it's a very important question. On the other hand, there is something that seems to be protected in this story, so maybe the corrections are not so severe. So maybe part of this picture. What I like about this is that even though it may be completely washed out when you include quantum corrections, maybe the language of the actual language in terms of D6 brains with these magnetic fluxes, since they seem to be accounting for the entropy as Gary and Roberto claim, and they seem to be consistent with all the classical properties that we have discussed here, at least it gives you somewhere in a string theory where to look for this. But of course, whenever supersymmetry is broken, even if you are on extremality, this is a very important question. And I don't know the answer to that. Gary.
So, you said you can packify on a 6 torus, and you view that as a product of 3-2 tori.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't allow an arbitrary angle in that original torus, do you? I mean, you have one moduli, which is sort of a size of the torus, and another moduli, which is the B field on that 2 torus.
Uh-huh.
So you've not included the other moduli, which would change the shape of the 2 torus. Is that correct?
In our initial solution, yeah, that was correct. We chose our moduli to be normalized by 1. That's why the only extra parameter that entered into our solution was this parameter, the equal B field. So the size is, so in other words, in more technical words, when I have these parameters, I think that I define them like this. I'm sorry. So, for instance, what we have declared is that x alpha I was b for all I, or j, sorry, and the moduli at infinity was normalized to 1. These are the sizes of the torus that you are talking about. In principle, when you use SL2R, these things are going to transform.
Yeah, but what I was leading to is the fact that when you go from the D0 D6 system with B field, and you do your 3 T dualities to get the intersecting 3 brains,
things are
now at funny angles because of the B field.
Yeah.
But there's no B field in the D3 brain picture, is there? Because your original tori were all sort of square.
Oh. I see. That could be correct, yeah, because it was a square to begin with. Yeah, okay, yeah. Uh-huh. So in that sense, it's
very similar.
It's extremely similar to what you did. Exactly.
So in the intersecting 3 brands, you don't have any B fields and you don't have any fluxes.
Exactly.
So the mass.
And this is because we were considering a square toroid to begin with.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Good. Thanks. Actually...